Hey everybody, today we have a pretty special episode. I have Oksana Ivanova as a guest again today. She was my very first guest a couple of weeks ago where we talked about gamification. And today she is going to ask me some questions about cryptocurrencies, blockchains, and everything that comes with it. She did some projects for the industry in terms of UX, building websites and things like that. And so she would like to learn more about that. So I am more than happy to answer her questions. So Oksana, welcome to the podcast again, and thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me again. So I have to warn you, so I haven't done my homework. I still don't know anything about crypto or blockchain or anything that you just said. So you will have to kind of really explain that pretty well, I guess, so I would understand everything that we're going to talk about right now. But before we dive into my crypto questions, you know, that I prepared for you, there's a list of crypto questions that I have. So sure. Tell us a little bit about your work, yourself, your background, and what actually you're doing and why we're talking about crypto right now. So, but first your background and then the rest. Go ahead.
Sure, sounds like a good segue. I got involved in the cryptocurrency space 2 years ago, exactly. I think in November of 2016, I was reading some news. And I mean, I read about Bitcoin much longer ago than that, but pretty much ignored the whole thing about it, which I shouldn't have. In the fall of 2016, I read stuff about Ethereum, how it was a decentralized blockchain for smart contracts, for decentralized applications. So basically the same underlying technology as Bitcoin, blockchain, decentralized ledger, but slightly different code with slightly different capabilities. So on Bitcoin, you can just transact with Bitcoins. You can, you know, send and receive, and that's it. That's the only thing that it does, and it does it very well. Ethereum is a different blockchain, which I think was written from scratch. Maybe some elements were borrowed from Bitcoin, or maybe Bitcoin was used as the base, but the protocol is pretty different. And so I read some news in the fall of 2016 about Ethereum, and got really fascinated by that. I also created an account on Coinbase and decided to buy some Ether, which is the coin of the Ethereum blockchain. And I think I bought like, you know, $500 worth. And actually for a month or so, I kind of forgot about that. And then I remembered and went back, and I see that my money doubled. So I think I bought it at like, you know, $8 per Ether, and then it was like 16 or something. So basically I got 1,000 out of that. So I decided to put in, I think, $500 more. And so kind of the rest is history. So over the next few months, I was putting, you know, more and more money into that, which, you know, kind of looking back, obviously I got lucky and made some bucks. I mean, nothing groundbreaking, nothing life-changing, but, you know, just a few bucks here and there. But at the same time, it was pretty risky because it could, it was already up several multiples from the ICO price, and it could crash, you know, 50% any day. But, you know, we all know that it went all the way up to pretty much $1,500. And so I went to some conferences, I learned about the space, and then a year ago in November, I reached out to a company called Zencash. They later rebranded into Horizon. They kept the currency name Zen, but they rebranded into Horizon. And I worked for them until last month, pretty much a year. as a software program manager and information architect. So basically, I managed most of the engineering projects, core protocol, you know, nodes and wallets and things like that. And whenever it was applicable, I also extensively contributed to the UX team on the UX side of things. So, for example, we were building a wallet, and we had a vendor, a third party company, build it for us. And I was actively participating in the in testing, in improving the UI and the logic, the information architecture of that. So that's kind of in brief my background on that topic.
Okay, so you're talking to, that's the firm, the Horizon. So do they have an app or something like that, or they have a web version of their product, or what are you talking about? Were you working on the app or the web space for their?
So Horizon is a blockchain. I mean, they have a website, and they have I think at least right now they have one Android application, which is a wallet. So if you want to store some Zen, like receive and send some Zen on your phone, there is an Android app for that. But Horizon itself is a blockchain with the cryptocurrency called Zen. So they are so kind of like slight history on the on the blockchain, on the cryptocurrency space, most coins were either forked from an existing coin, which means they just, you know, took the open source code, which for the most coins it's open source on GitHub, and they either kept it the same or they put in some improvements into the protocol or, you know, whatnot. And but it's still considered, you know, a copy of. So for example, the most famous privacy cryptocurrency is Zcash. They forked off of Bitcoin, and then they built in a pretty awesome technology into the code called ZK-SNARK. It's basically zero knowledge proof, which allows for anonymous and privacy transactions. So for Bitcoin, for example, as awesome as the technology is, the ledger of Bitcoin is public. So if somebody knows your Bitcoin address, they can just look it up and they can see the balance. They can see all the transactions that you did, whether it's incoming or outgoing. And then they can also link to those other addresses that you sent to or they sent to you and look up their histories and, you know, so on. But Zcash, for example, it allows to transact anonymously. So nobody needs to know who sent to whom and how much. And you can also include a small memo with the transaction. And so Horizon forked off of, so Zcash forked off of Bitcoin, and they introduced the ZK SNARK technology into the protocol. Then there was a coin, and they still exist, called Z Classic. They forked off of Zcash, and I think they changed some kind of something, nothing fundamental, just you know, governance wise or something like that. And then Zencash, they forked off of Z Classic, and then they introduced some of their own improvements into that code, and that they still are introducing more and more improvements into the code. So so basically, you know, they have been called, I think they finally walked away from that, but they've been called a fork of a fork of a fork. So and so most of the coins originated from the Bitcoin code. Some were written from either from scratch or from using Bitcoin as a base, but then most other tokens came from Ethereum, and that kind of leads us to the ICO thing, where people basically, you know, printed those tokens on top of the Ethereum blockchain, because those smart contracts allowed to create unlimited number of tokens on top of the Ethereum blockchain. So you didn't need your own blockchain, you could just use Ethereum and issue your tokens on top of the Ethereum blockchain, and then, you know, sell it to people as part of your ICO.
Okay, good. You know, that's really complicated, I'd say. You have to follow all these coins and all these new ideas of, you know, forking tokens and coins from different stuff. So I would like to ask you about, you know, just on the verge of what we're talking about, would you recommend investing in cryptocurrency right now at the moment? Do you think, remembering that you started gambling, you know, back then, right, on that, would be the right word to use, gambling in this case, for cryptocurrency?
So that's a really good question. So in terms of calling what I did back then gambling, as an outsider, you probably could. As an insider, I thought, like, my genuine thoughts were, because I did not buy into Bitcoin until later. I didn't really, you know, buy the vision and stuff like that. But I did buy into Ethereum because as I learned about, you know, decentralized concepts, how, you know, there's no middleman, right? You can transact, you can build decentralized applications, and there would be nobody in the middle to, you know, either censor what you do or make you jump through hoops. So basically, you know, there's only miners in the middle who put transactions in the block, and then they put the block on the blockchain through the process called mining, which I don't know why they called it like that. It's basically processing all those transactions, solving some complex equations through which you basically put the transaction in the block and then put the block on the blockchain. And that's why it's called the blockchain. And it's basically immutable ledger. So once the transaction is in the block on the blockchain, you cannot go back and change it. That's kind of one of the beauty of the blockchain, that, you know, nobody can, you know, break it, and nobody has broken it to date, because it's such a heavy mathematical encryption. And so going back to your question, I truly bought into that vision of Ethereum, and to me it was not gambling. I kind of believed that it was really, really revolutionary technology, and I am one of the lucky ones to kind of, you know, read about that, understand that, kind of given my technology background, I was able to connect some, you know, dots at the technology level. And I just thought that, you know, there would be a high demand for Ethereum, because in order to transact and to execute decentralized applications and smart contracts on top of Ethereum, including ICOs, you need Ether. Ether is kind of the fuel, right? In order to send a transaction, you need to pay a little bit of Ether. In order to execute a smart contract, you need to pay Ether. So, you know, I figure that this is a commodity, right? Like oil, you know, people will always need oil. I mean, hopefully we walk away from oil pretty soon for, you know, climate change purposes. That's how I thought about Ethereum. And I bought into that based on that. And I was really lucky enough to kind of catch that wave, because Ethereum exploded. But then I did not really hold everything to the point of, you know, $1,500, because there were several crashes along the way, and I sold a couple of times, never at a loss, but, you know, I could have had a lot more money if I, you know, waited, but, you know, it just doesn't work like that. And so I wouldn't call it gambling, because that's how my interest and my investing started. But then, as I learned more, and my investments pretty much for the most part ended last January, a year ago, when you know that Bitcoin reached like, you know, $20,000 per coin in December or January, and Ethereum was at all-time high of almost 1500 around the same time frame. But then everything just started crashing like a rock, and I was lucky enough to kind of, you know, learn about what's going on. There's been a lot of fraudulent activities. I mean, you can read about that everywhere. Now SEC, which is the securities so basically the securities commission that oversees all that trading of securities in the US, they are now investigating quite a few exchanges and ICO companies and things like that. So, and once I learned that, I pretty much sold everything. And I mean, still made some money, but again, nothing groundbreaking. Would have been much better if I sold it at 20, but I sold Bitcoin. It was like around $12,000 per coin. And so to finally answer your question, whether I would recommend investing or not, I mean, I'm not going to give any financial advice. I'm just going to say that I'm not investing anymore at this point, because I believe that there's still a lot of uncertainty and manipulation of the market. Some bad actors are still there. They are being investigated, but they are still operating as of this recording. And so, as many people thought that, you know, it's a bear market, right? I mean, bear market is a normal thing, happens in the stock market all the time, every, you know, 8 to 10 years. So I believe we are entering the bear market in the U.S. stock market right now. But I really don't want to think about it this way, because most of the prices have been inflated by those manipulations and tokens that have been printed out of thin air. And probably starting back at when Bitcoin was around 1,000. So when about a month ago or a month and a half ago, when everybody kind of got comfortable that, you know, maybe finally Bitcoin found its bottom at, you know, $6,500 or something like that, dollars per coin. And it stayed there for months, kind of like, you know, fluctuating a little bit, but still within the between $6,000 and $7,000. But then it just crashed overnight, and it went under six. And not only it crashed overnight, next day or 2 days after, it crashed more. And then, you know, 2 or 3 days later, it was under five. And so now we are trading at, you know, $3,300, $3,400 per coin. So as an investment, if somebody wants to take a gamble, because at this point it will be a gambling, I mean, feel free to do so. I personally not looking at the space for the near future, because I personally think Bitcoin will go even lower. I don't know where it will stop. And when assuming that regulators take all the fraud out of the system, which is a pretty hard task. I mean, they are kind of starting to dig, and there have been some, you know, arrests or, you know, indictments or things like that. I mean, the whole system is just penetrated end to end with all kinds of bad actors. And that's what makes it pretty, you know, tricky to treat the space as an investment opportunity. If you talk about the utility of Bitcoin, it's a great utility. It just allows you to transfer, doesn't matter how much value, in 10 minutes or so to anybody. Like, you know, if you want to make a wire to somebody, or if you want to just move the money from your bank to an exchange, or, I mean, whatever, right? Whatever you do. it takes several days. And then if you want to make a wire, you have to call your bank. Like from my personal experience, spend 30 minutes on the phone, and then they would send the money to your to that recipient account, and you will be lucky if your transaction doesn't get flagged, because once in a while regulators flag transactions, you know, for kind of anti-money laundering purposes. And so with Bitcoin, I mean, for the good and for the bad, you can move millions of dollars in 10 minutes to anybody in the world without any middleman in the middle, right? There's no bank, there's no nothing. I mean, you are, your wallet is a bank, right? So you could send $100,000 to your friend in Africa and they will get it in 10 minutes. So this is an absolute beauty of that. As an investment, it's and I'll kind of end this answer with the fact that even if you take all the fraud out of the system, which I hope eventually we do, it is really, really hard to put a value on the Bitcoin or on Ether, because there's really no, it's really hard to calculate the intrinsic value of the coin. For example, you know, if you take a company, they have real cash flow, right? Like, for example, Microsoft makes X amount of dollars, and their share trades at about, you know, a certain percentage of, so the capitalization of the company represents a certain percentage of the earnings, or the other way around. So there's some kind of a way to measure that intrinsic value, and then you can kind of use that as the baseline, and then as the price goes up or down, you can understand how much, you know, hype is built into the share of Microsoft, or whether it's undervalued. But with Bitcoin, it's really hard to do so. There's no cash flow, there's no company behind that. There are no statements. There were people who tried to come up with their own theories. I don't know whether they are right or wrong. Back then, it kind of made sense to me. Now, looking back, I would say maybe it doesn't make that much sense anymore. But there were people who said, you know, you can measure the ballpark valuation of Bitcoin, for example, or any other network for that matter, based on the utility. So if, for example, if the network has, let's say, 1,000 transactions a day, and then that makes it, you know, 365,000 transactions a year, then this number should be multiplied by, you know, I can't remember the number that they came up with, whether it's like 50,000 or something like that, but like some random number. Maybe there's some math behind that, but basically they said the only way to calculate, or the best way to calculate the ballpark valuation of Bitcoin, the market cap, is to kind of take that number of daily transactions, because that's how you kind of understand the value of Bitcoin, right? Like the more people transact on the Bitcoin network by utilizing the network, right? Like I send you Bitcoin because it's convenient. People send me Bitcoin because it's convenient. We kind of skip the banks and everything like that. So that provides value. And so you kind of take that number of transactions and you multiply it by that number. But again, this number is like, I don't know what that number means, where it came from. And so this is the only way that I remember people tried to calculate the value of Bitcoin. And so if you look at it right now at 3,300 per coin, I know we have been at 20,000 and now it's at 3,300. So a lot of people may say, you know, wow, that's a bargain, right? It's, you know, 80 or 70% down from the all-time high. But at the same time, I have no way of telling whether 3,300 is a good price. Maybe, you know, 300 is a good price for Bitcoin, or maybe 6,000 is a legit price. But nobody really knows that, and maybe some smart people who are much smarter than me, maybe they do, but I certainly don't. And by, you know, being in the space for a couple of years and learning a lot about it, my personal preference is to stay on the sidelines and kind of watch that evolve.
Okay, I see. So that answer actually covered my next question when I wanted to ask you about Bitcoin, you know, just like as a phenomenon of the Bitcoin, but I guess you pretty much covered that. And I just wanted to make a side note about Ether, because when you were talking about, there was a really good game, you remember, I'm a gamification person, in probably late zeros, I guess. There was a really great strategy game where you have to use Ether for different sort of transactions, and it was about creatures and ruling the world, but still, I kind of got
that
idea.
CryptoKitties or?
Etherlords, as I remember, they are really, really good. I strongly recommend everyone who's listening to that. So,
okay.
So, really good one. The second part of that game is actually not really good, so don't play that. But the first one is just amazing. Do you really?
What's the name of that first game that you are recommending?
Etherlords, actually. So.
Oh, Etherlords. Okay.
Yeah. So they are kind of really, really good at that thing. So really fun one. Speaking about Bitcoin and blockchain, you know, I wanted to ask, you know, like, I want to give you a challenge. Imagine that you have to explain that to your grand-grand-grand-grand-grandma. And how would you put that Bitcoin and blockchain technology? How can you use that for financial security? Not really financial security, but how to operate with that if you're facing with, I don't know, 90-year-old elderly women? How would you explain them how this thing works actually? How is it in this real world?
So, first of all, I think our grandparents have seen enough of stuff in their lives, and we should probably spare them of trying to explain to them what that is, because I really don't think that they need to know about that. But if certain grandparents are, you know, pretty interested in the new technology, then... you know, the simplest way to really explain blockchain, which again is the underlying technology of Bitcoin, is that it's a decentralized ledger of transactions, which means that there is a copy of the Bitcoin ledger, for example, in the Bitcoin case, on several thousand computers around the world. Which are called nodes. So they maintain at all times a copy of that ledger. So when somebody sends a Bitcoin to somebody, transaction goes into that mempool, they call it, probably came from the word memory pool, I would assume. So it's called mempool. And then miners, they grab those transactions, process them, put them on the block, and put the block on the blockchain. And that block propagates to every single reachable node of the Bitcoin network. And what this means is that even if somebody wants to hack, which is extremely hard to do in the first place, Bitcoin ledger, they will basically have to hack all, I think at this point it's 10,000 nodes across the world of Bitcoin. They will basically have to hack every single node of that of the network and modify the ledger to, you know, achieve their, you know, goals. So that's kind of the simple explanation. The Bitcoins that you send to each other, those are, you know, not real coins, right? They are just records, that they are transactions that get recorded into the ledger that is distributed across thousands and thousands of nodes, computers around the world, who help maintain the network security and stability. This technology, obviously, you know, it goes a lot deeper into, from the technical standpoint, you know, the protocols, the encryption, the mining algorithms, and all those, you know, hashes and things like that. Just to put it in a simple way, it's basically, there's nobody in the middle. It's a fully decentralized ledger that people can use for to perform transactions. And when you own your Bitcoin, right, when you have the private keys to your wallet, and it doesn't mean that like you store your coins on like Coinbase, right, or some other exchange, because in this case they own your private keys and they own your coins. Just like in the real financial industry, like a bank, right? If you have your money in the bank, you kind of own your money, but the bank owns your money technically. So if the government wants to come after you, or if the bank detects some kind of fraudulent activity, they can just freeze your assets and not give it to you. So you'll have to, you know, jump through a lot of hoops. The beauty of the cryptocurrency is that if you own the private keys, then nobody can ever take your Bitcoin away from you, unless, you know, of course, if somebody puts the gun to your head and you just give it to them, right? Just like, you know, anybody can take your cash or your iPhone if you walk down the street somewhere. You know, if you own your Bitcoin and you own your private keys, you really own it. It's just like cash, but it's digital, and you don't need to, you know, report it to anybody. You don't need to, as you travel across borders, you know, I think they have like a $10,000 limit. Otherwise, you have to declare that. So it basically just, you know, eliminates all that, all those hurdles of the physical world, and they give you the power of ownership, right? So, and you know, if all that was stable, I would probably store a lot of money, a lot of my savings in Bitcoin or a similar coin, right? But because there's no stability, all this volatility and fraud and manipulation, you know, the money you put in today can be, you know, 50% tomorrow or in a week. You know, again, in terms of utility and the benefits, it's really absolutely revolutionary, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see. And I guess to wrap our talk today, I would like you to share, you been working there 2 years in the field, right? As you said, in the tech.
Well, I've been exploring the space for a year, and then the second year I joined the Horizon organization, and I went, you know, really deep into the technology piece, because okay, I basically managed all the core engineering projects. So it was kind of like nuts and bolts of Bitcoin protocol and
That's exactly what I wanted to ask. Do you have any funny, interesting, memorable story about your experience, personal experience, you know, working with crypto and all this stuff, and that you had to do, that you can or want to share regarding cryptocurrency?
Personal experience that would be...
Yeah, what was the most memorable thing? You know, you just discovered that 2 years ago, and once you started working, what was the difference between, you know, being an insider, an outsider? Was that something that you wouldn't expect finding yourself, you know, something that would strike you differently?
Well, I think what struck me the most is that how still very unregulated the space is. Mm-hmm. So back in 2013-14, Bitcoin was propelled, again, most likely by manipulations, from, you know, the original Bitcoin price started at, like, you know, cents, right? Like 60 cents or whatnot. And then eventually, and that was in 2009, and that's when, like, nobody really knew about it, nobody cared about it, but only like a handful of people realized the potential of the technology. But then it started trading on several exchanges, and people started understanding the value, you know, the easiness of transactions and stuff like that. But then in 2013 or 2014, it was basically, again, manipulated from whatever the price level was back then to, I think, it maxed out at 12 or 1300 per coin, and then it crashed and to like $200. And so then it kind of remained in the bear market territory for quite some time. And that's when other coins appeared, like, you know, Litecoin, and then later in 2015 and 2016, Ethereum. But then still today, and I think SEC and regulators, I think they investigated those kind of fraudulent activities in the industry back then. But, you know, still as of pretty much last year, and I mentioned before that regulators are looking into some fraudulent activities right now. But as early as last year, in the summer of 2017, it was like the hottest summer of all those ICOs, where hundreds of millions of dollars were printed out of thin air when people just, you know, hey, we're going to do $150 million ICO, and they would raise it in like 2 hours. It's absolutely ridiculous. So between inflated prices of Bitcoin and Ethereum, people had a lot of money that obviously was very easy to spend or invest, and they just invested a lot of that money into all those ICOs. And that's kind of what struck me the most, because anybody could do that. There were some websites that said, you know, once they detected your IP, they said, you know, we cannot offer our tokens to U.S. citizens or U.S. residents. So, you know, if you were in Europe, you were, you know, a little luckier than people who were in the U.S. But that's what still kind of strikes me the most, because, you know, there's a lot of people who have done really deep analysis of all those fraudulent activities. There are like physical, pretty tangible proofs of those things. So basically, for regulators, they just need to pick up that report and start, you know, knocking on doors and, you know, throwing people in jail or, you know, whatever. But as of this recording, it's still not really happening. I mean, some things are moving, but that's still what strikes me the most, how U.S. Financial regulators are still, you know, kind of not being very proactive, because millions of people are losing their life savings. And I mean, those people who kind of bought into that and didn't do the homework and things like that. So a lot of people around the world, and in the US particularly, are losing, you know, life savings or just, you know, large amounts of money due to, imagine people who bought Bitcoin at $20,000, right? Whether they sold it on the way down or they held it until now. So just imagine the mental state of those people and the financial, the banking account, how it depleted over time. So that's kind of what still strikes me the most about the space.
Okay, I see. So it's kind of a risky thing, and it's kind of, you need to be emotionally tough for handling all these ups and downs, I guess. So yeah, sounds like something. Not everyone can do that. I guess first, not everyone can understand that what you're talking about. Not everyone can actually have the guts to dive deeper into that and try something, I guess. So yeah, Vitalik, thank you. It was really exciting, I guess, and it was really insightful in a sense, because well, I learned quite a lot because I didn't know nothing, just in nothing at all. And that was really nice talking to you, and thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Oksana, for asking me all these questions. I always enjoy talking about things that, you know, I know a thing or two about. So it was a pretty good experience for me to kind of dig into my memory and remember what has happened over the last 2 years and share my thoughts with you and the listeners. So thank you for coming, and we'll probably be scheduling some more episodes in the future where we'll be talking about some other UX related stuff, or, you know, maybe you'll have some different types of questions for me. But for the listeners, if you guys have any questions based on what we talked today, and you would like to dig a little deeper into certain aspects of the discussion, I'll be more than happy to either, you know, answer them on Twitter, or if I get enough questions, I can just, you know, record a separate episode where I will answer some of those questions. So Oksana, thank you again, and everybody who is listening, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and have a great day.